He paused, stared, turned sideways, and dropped his eyes.
Sookies?
He asked.
Where from?
Station Hotel. Police found it, Dad said.
He was staring into the wood burner in the range, his face red from the heat. I was grateful he wasn't crying anymore. Ma had stopped her kneading when Douglas came in and stood rigid, a silk scarf and the belt of a dress reaching like creepers up to her elbow. I slowly unwound them and pushed the knickers I'd gathered from the floor back into the case.
They've been through it already, Dad said.
So that was why everything had been in such a mess. I imagined big policemen's hands rooting through the underwear. It was a horrible thought. Perhaps Douglas was thinking that too, because he looked sick for a moment.
Find anything? He asked.
Dad shook his head.
Nothing really, except her ration book. She left it in her suitcase. Douglas made it sound like the answer to a riddle.
And the people at the hotel, what do they say?
They've no recollection of seeing her. Her name's in the register. Receptionist's handwriting, not hers. But they didn't recognise her photo.
So did she stay there or not? I asked. My chest felt full of air and I thought my lungs might burst. Nobody answered. Ma didn't move, didn't say anything, but I saw tears fall onto silk and watched as they made dark circles on the material. It was me who washed everything, in the end.
I'm halfway along Elizabeth's Road before I know where I'm going. It's full of children in dull, untidy uniforms on their way to, or possibly from, school. I stumble through a knot of them. They smell of unwashed gym kits and cheap cologne, and I find I'm staring at their rucksacks and record bags, expecting to see a brown leather suitcase with a brown leather handle. Even at Elizabeth's door, I'm still glancing back to check. I ring the bell, look through the front window, and peer in at the kitchen. But I can't see anything. The house seems dark and unlived in.
Look, it's some geriatric burglar,
someone shouts. A gang of children. Teenagers, I suppose you'd call them. Katie's age, swagger about the pavement, slapping at their fellows and dragging their bags along the ground. The boy who shouted is grinning at me.
How are you going to get in?
He calls,
"Stand a stairlift."
The others laugh, and I turn to see where he's pointing. The landing window is open. How useful it would be if I really did have a stairlift to take me up there. I might just fit through that window. I wonder if it has been open before. I nearly missed it this time. I wonder if anything else is open. I try the side gate, but that's wishful thinking. If only I could pull the outer wall away to see if Elizabeth is in there. Take the front off like a doll's house. Or like Douglas's house after the bombs were dropped.
Of course, I really wouldn't want anything like that to happen, and I feel slightly ashamed of wishing for a bomb. But I do want to ask about the open window. So I step round to the next door neighbour's. There's no bell. And when I knock, a dog starts barking. It gets louder and more aggressive sounding as I wait, until it seems as if it's right behind the door. I start to back away, but just as I reach the pavement, the door opens and the dog bounds out. It runs around me, whining and sniffing.
"Don't worry," the owner says. "He won't bite or anything. He's just curious." "Did you knock?"
I stare at the owner. He's young, just a boy, and has messy brown hair. Very messy. The dog starts to lick my hand, and I pat it on the head.
"You must give off good vibes," the boy says. "He usually only does that to people he knows."
I smile, glad to have been singled out, glad to have found a friend.
I always wanted a dog when I was young. My parents said we couldn't afford it, and they were probably right. But I was haunted by a story about a dog that was found dead in someone's yard. It had been tied up and left without food and water after the owner had gone away. Mrs. Winners told us about it to prove we shouldn't give up hope, that people were moving at the drop of a hat nowadays, doing moonlight flits, that Suki might have done the same. No time to even consider their pets, she said. It's the way of the world now. But it was the other details that struck me at the time. The yard was one near Frank's, and the dog was found only a few days after Dad and I had been to his house. It must have barked and barked, Mrs. Winners said, hoping someone would come and rescue it. How I wished, for years I wished, that I had been that someone, had followed the barking when I'd heard it, and saved the dog. This dog in front of me whines as if it knows the turn of my thoughts. I pat him again, longing to be young and supple so I could crouch down and rub his coat properly. Shut up, Vincent, the boy says. He's just going for the sympathy vote, hoping you've got a biscuit on you. I begin to look through my bag. Oh, no, he says. Don't. We've got plenty. It's just greedy. You're not a friend of Mum's, are you? Did you want something? No, I say. No. Thank you. Wasn't it you who knocked? I don't think so, I say, walking away. The dog follows me to the end of the path and then runs off when its owner calls. I keep looking back towards Elizabeth's house as I walk home. If only there was some way of getting in. It starts to drizzle in the park, and it quickly becomes a downpour. I stand for a moment under some trees. I stood here once, long ago, with my mother. I remember it being dark like this, the sky glowering, and the earth too sodden to give off that fresh smell of the outdoors. I'd followed her here, more or less, after a row with my father. She'd been at the garden gate when I got home from Audrey's, and I could see Dad silhouetted in the light of the kitchen door. How could you, Lillian? I heard him shout. My first instinct was to run into the larder and cover my head, but instead I waited on the pavement, half hidden by Mrs. Winner's hedge. What was I supposed to do? Ma yelled back, pulling her Macintosh close against the rain. There are still four mouths to feed in this house. And it's not like I can ask Frank for help any more. Frank, again? You never stop talking about that man. Never mind he was the death of our daughter. He never was. He just isn't a sour-faced Methodist like all the people you admire. And don't think I don't know who's put that idea in your head. I couldn't hear what Dad said to that, but I heard Ma shout, Yes, I mean Douglas. He could never leave Suki alone. Of course he'd like to accuse Frank. I looked at the windows above, hoping Douglas wasn't in, and then watched as Ma marched off down the road, raindrops making the brim of her hat sag sadly. When I finally moved, I found Dad still standing by the kitchen door. He threw his hands up as he spotted me. You're determined to get wet through too, I see, he said. After a moment, I followed him inside. Douglas was sitting at the table, concentrating on his food, and I wondered how much he'd heard. There was a towel hanging on the back of the chair by the fire. It smelled of gravy, but I rubbed my face and hair with it while Dad told me I deserved to get pneumonia. I took my wet skirt off and hung it on the chair where the towel had been, and Douglas stared at me for a moment in my petticoat. What's going on? I asked, as no one had bothered to tell me.
Frank's back, Douglas said.
His eyes were narrowed, and he was holding a spoon as though he might try to stab someone with it.
They arrested him off the train from London.
Arrested him?
Why? Have they found... I mean, is there any news on Suki?
Nothing yet. Just the coupon fraud so far.
He shook chutney off his spoon fiercely. It spattered onto his pullover and he muttered something under his breath. Dad sat down to his own half-finished meal, frowning at the shredded cabbage. But you think there will be something?
No doubt. When they find out what sort of a man he is, a drunk, a criminal, the sort of man that should never have been allowed to marry Suki, the sort of man no parent should ever allow near his daughters.
Dad's fork clattered against his plate.
Thank you for that, Douglas, he said. I'm sure you mean well, but you can keep your opinions to yourself in the future.
I leant against the sink, watching Douglas's face as it screwed tight before relaxing enough to chew. For a few minutes he looked like his old self, ducking his head and bending right over his food to eat. I almost expected him to sit back with a,
"This chutney sure is swell."
But he was staring at his leftover mutton gristle when he spoke again.
"Mr. Palmer," he said, "you do think it was Frank, don't you?"
Dad stared at him across the table.
"You do think it must have been him? You do want him to be locked away?"
"We don't know if she's dead," I said.
"None of that will bring her back," Dad said at the same time.
Then, turning to me,
"Maud," he said, "the police told us. The likelihood now is that she isn't still living. You must understand that."
I looked away at the rain-soaked garden, wondering where Ma was.
"Maud," Dad said again.
He reached a hand towards me. "Yes, yes," I said, pushing away from the sink and taking Dad's old greatcoat from its hook. I was trying to be as mechanical as possible, trying not to let myself think.
"You're going after your mother?"
Dad got up as I made for the kitchen door.
"Don't, Maud. You should know. She's been using Suki's ration book."
"That's what you've been arguing about," I said, moving stiff and puppet-like. Dad nodded, and Douglas behind him. I looked at them sitting together, a united front. No wonder Ma preferred the dismal night to the two of them, here, like this, stony-faced and against her. Still eating, I noted, the food they were so morally opposed to having. I felt something rush up through me and my breath rasped into my throat. "If Suki's dead," I shouted, "what does it matter?" I banged out of the house and took the route I'd seen Ma take, down the street and into the park. It was still raining heavily. The grass was waterlogged and the air was cold. I wished I had better shoes on and realized I didn't know where I was going or how far Ma might have walked. But I was too angry to stop and go back home, angry with Dad's petty worries in the face of Suki's disappearance, angry at his weak acceptance of Douglas's interpretation, and angry at having been made to take sides. I kept going past the bandstand and onto the north gate before turning back towards the wilder bit of the park. It was there I found Ma. She had stopped under the trees where it was still wet, but not so exposed. The park seemed like a flat sea, and Ma, standing, looking out, was a ship's captain surveying the water, the tall, dark trees behind her, a huge wave about to engulf the ship. I thought she might have been crying on the walk there, but it could just have been the rain. She saw me and held her head up so I could see her eyes under her hat. "If you're going to weigh in about that book, then you can cook your own meals, same as they can from now on," she said. But then she opened her arms, and I went straight to her. "She wasn't with him," she said, into my hair, which the rain had plastered to my scalp. "Frank's come back, but she wasn't with him." I pressed my face into her shoulder, and she stroked my wet head. I thought. I'd hoped. You know what I'd hoped. But she wasn't with him. And do you believe it, Maud? She asked, holding me away from her for a moment. Do you believe Frank could have done it? Douglas said he was a nasty drunk. Was he? A copy of the Daily Echo blew past, and I watched it flapping like a fish as it came to rest against the nearest tree. I did see Frank drunk once, I said, feeling I had to say something. But he wasn't nasty to Suki. Not exactly. Sort of the opposite. Sort of. Ma nodded, smiled a bit. Thought so, she said. And he probably didn't like Doug very much because of the amount of time he spent there. What? Ma said, turning my face up to hers and smoothing my hair back. I felt a drop of rain splash onto my face. Doug, I said. One of Suki's neighbours said he was there all the time, and I suppose Frank didn't much like that. Douglas was there all the time? Why? I shrugged. The woman thought he was Suki's fancy man. But that's stupid, isn't it, Ma? Isn't it? She let go of me and began to walk back across the park. I followed, avoiding the puddles which her feet found, and trying to draw a dry breath in through the rain. As we got to the darkly covered bandstand, a shadow slipped beyond the trees. Come on, just come out of the rain, someone said from the blackness of the bandstand, and Ma and I stopped as one, straining to see into the gloom. It's pelting down, you'll catch your death. It was Douglas's voice, and then his face, shining down at us like an owl's. He started at the sight of us, and his skin seemed unnaturally white. "Who are you talking to?" Ma said, looking round. "You?" he said, though he looked over our heads at the expanse of inky turf. "I thought you should come in out of the rain. Who else would I be talking to?" Ma stared at him for several seconds, then turned very deliberately towards the trees. There was nothing there. "Well, I don't want to huddle under a bandstand for the rest of the night," she said. "Let's get home." Our footsteps on the path held a liquid ring, and I was glad to be heading for our kitchen and a hot fire. But before we reached the steps down to the street, I looked back. It only took a moment to recognize the figure of the mad woman. She was crouched on the open grass, pinned by the rain, her umbrella propped against her side, unopened. And I suddenly knew that it was she Douglas had been speaking to. She he had been pleading with to come out of the rain. Chapter 8 Snake and Kidney Pie. That was one of Dad's. And Nosmo King sits here. Do you remember, Helen? He'd put the no smoking sign on your placemat. Used to drive waitresses mad with his nonsense. My son is over from Germany with his wife and children. They're talking and laughing, their voices echoing over each other the way they do underwater. I can hear what they say, making jokes of some kind. But somehow, I can't make the sentences fit together. I lose track. Still, I laugh along with the others. It doesn't matter what the joke is. It's nice to laugh. My face aches from smiling, and I am so warm. My daughter's on one side, my son on the other. I've got a bit of a rhyme running through my brain, but it runs too fast to catch it all. There was an old woman who lived in a shell. That's not quite right, but I can't think what it was she did live in. Anyway, I feel as if I'm inside a shell, and I'm an old woman, so perhaps I'm allowed to change the rhyme a bit. There was an old woman. I used to read that to these children of mine, Tom and Helen. I used to read it to them.
Of course, we're really in a sort of cafe, not a shell. It has a glass-domed ceiling and pearly walls, and lots of those things for drinking, for putting drinks in, on the table. Katie is laughing with her cousins opposite me, and I've finished whatever it is I've been eating. Broth, perhaps, without any bread. That's what the old woman gives the children.
Shall we think about getting you home, Mum?
Helen stretches herself as she stands, showing off her long legs. She might be 50, but she's as lithe as anything. Being a gardener must keep you fit. My left side feels suddenly chilly where she was sitting against it. A current of cold water in a warm sea.
No, I'd rather stay a little longer, I say, not getting up. I'm having a nice time.
Helen bites her top lip with her bottom teeth. They are tiny pearl squares against the flesh.
It will take an hour to get you home and settled, she says. I know you're enjoying yourself, but...
Oh, let us stay a bit longer.
Tom puts an arm round my shoulder.
Not often you get out, is it, Mum?
I take her out every week, actually. I'm here for her, unlike some people.
Helen's tone makes me wince, but Tom smiles.
I know, dearest sister, you are a saint.
No, really. I'm not being sarcastic. He stands too.
You know I appreciate everything you do for Mum, but I don't see her that often, so it would be nice. Look, we'll drop her home if you like, and you can get off.
Helen tilts her face towards the sky. A cloud shaped like a shoe is visible through the glass in the domed ceiling.
You wouldn't know what to do with her when you got her home, she tells Tom. She needs everything set out for her, otherwise she gets confused. Britta can deal with that. Just tell her what to do.
There's a silence. I wonder whether to shout that I'm not an imbecile.
No, I'll stay, Helen says finally. After all, Katie's having a good time too.
Just you who's here on sufferance.
Tom sneaks in the last sentence and gets a whack on the shoulder from his sister.
Katie does seem to be enjoying herself. I suppose she doesn't get to see her cousins very often. They always take a while to warm to each other. A shame, because by the time they're getting on, it's usually time to go. I watch them laughing and chatting. They look very different. Katie's got her mother's blondish curls, always a bit messy. She never listens when I tell her to run a brush through them. Not even when she was a little girl. I'm not going to meet the Queen, she used to say. Made me laugh to hear her. Anna and Frederick would never need to be told. They both have dark, glossy hair that lies very straight. Both children smile at me and call me Grandma, but I feel like they're strangers.
I like your socks, Anna, I say, though I hadn't meant to break into her conversation. They're very smart.
She looks at me, startled, and pulls the socks up higher over her knees.
You see, Britta says, I told you Grandma would like them. They're your favourite ones, aren't they, Anna?
She smiles at me, the way parents do when their children aren't being quite as polite as they'd like them to be. Anna nods, but she seems to have forgotten what she was talking about before.
My fault. I try to think of something to say, to help her out.
I used to have socks like that.
Good job, too. Girls wore skirts to the knee when I was young, and we had no tights. I remember walking along the front with my parents, and ooh, it was freezing.
We'd started at the top of the cliffs, making a zigzag down towards the beach. Dad didn't want us going too far onto the sand, what with all the barbed wire still piled up, and the who knew what which had been buried to keep the Nazis away. So I didn't paddle,
but I did get close enough to feel the spray of the sea and to find shells like tiny pleated skirts washed up and blown onto the path. We walked a long way that day, past the pier, watching the waves crash against the beach. And Dad held my arm as if I might vanish, same as Suki. I hated being so closely held, especially with him and Ma arguing all the way. She'd said something about Frank when we were only yards from the house, and Dad hadn't let the subject drop since.
"If only Suki had left him," he said. "Every other couple in this country seems to be getting a divorce. Why couldn't they have done that? Then she'd have been back living with us, safe."
"You said last week you didn't hold with divorce," Ma said.
"Well, it all depends on the character of the husband, doesn't it?"
He looked for a moment at Ma.
"Or the behaviour of the wife."
I held a shell to my ear, letting the hollow gush drown their voices, and then pulled away from Dad as we reached the dancing shack. It was a sort of wooden hut on the path by a turning up towards town where they'd sold drinks and things before the war. It was shut now, with boards nailed over the windows and the old awning just a tatty fringe. It smelt of the sea, salty and rotten, and of wood and damp. Grass had sown itself onto the roof, so that it seemed to have hair which waved in the wind. Suki had called it the dancing shack, because the grass made the hut look as if it was swaying to some unheard music. Salt had caused the grain of the wood to open and pucker, and there were holes where knots had fallen out. We used to run our fingers over the walls and feed tiny stones and shells and even handfuls of sand through the holes. I'd like to think of it filling up a bit more every time we came to the beach. And one day, the hut would be whipped away, leaving a densely moulded copy in its place. Like a giant sandcastle. Letting my parents walk on, I ran a hand over a weathered board, knocking my knuckles against it, and heard a sort of flapping shuffle somewhere close by. I looked up at the grass on the roof, but couldn't see anything. So I walked round behind, wondering if there was a nest somewhere. My friend Audrey had had pigeons breeding in her family's beach hut the spring before, and she'd been terribly upset about her father smashing the eggs. I reached the far corner, still not able to see anything, and was about to poke a finger through a hole when I saw the gleam of an eye. I jumped back, nearly falling over the slope of a dune. This wasn't a pigeon. It was a human eye. Someone was inside, looking out. I could hear a voice from within, whispering about glass smashing and birds flying, whispering about a van and soil and summer squash, whispering until the whisper broke and whoever it was inside the dancing shack was suddenly shouting, "I'm watching! I'm watching you!" I didn't doubt it. The eye stared straight at me through the hole in the wood. And desperate to get out of its line of vision, I ran after Dad, my heart thumping. When I looked back, there was a figure coming away from the hut, an umbrella in her hand. It was the madwoman. She shouted after me, repeating in a yell the words she'd whispered. And then, just before I was out of earshot, I thought she said Suki's name. I stopped and nearly went back, but she was always shouting and I was frightened. So instead, I caught up with Dad and let him hold my arm the rest of the way home.
I'm quite tipsy by the time Tom helps me into the car. Helen buckles me in and gives him a list of instructions for taking me home. She wants to make sure he doesn't forget to lock me in the house. Tom drops the paper onto the dashboard and hugs her before she hurries away. "Has she gone to tell the woman off and get our peach slices back?" I ask him.
"What?"
"Nothing," I say. "It was nonsense." I'm quite emotional, partly because I don't know when he and the family will be over from Germany next, and partly because of the wine. I have a little sob in the car, and the children shift about behind me. We go home a funny way. Tom no longer remembers the roads. And we pass Elizabeth's house. The side gate is open. I sit up and look back out of the window. "Could you drop me here?" I say to Tom. "I'd rather walk the last bit." He looks unsure but slows the car. "Side gate," I say to myself. "Side gate, side gate, side gate."
"Helen said to make sure she was in the house, Tom," Britta says from the back seat. "I don't think we should just let your mother out here."
"I'm not an imbecile," I say over my shoulder, "and I haven't forgotten where I live yet. I often walk back through the park, and I'd like to do that today." I put cold hands to my hot face. Lying makes me flush.
"Okay, Mum," Tom says, pulling over, "if that's what you want. But don't tell Helen, or it'll be curtains for me."
I smile at the twinkle in his eye. He always was the more charming of my two children. I get out, untangling myself from the seatbelt, and blow kisses at the grandchildren. Britta gets out too and gives me a hug.
"I only want to make sure you are safe," she says.
I tell her I know. I tell her I'm grateful. And I wave them off, watching until the car disappears around a corner. All the time I'm trying to cling to two words as they slip easily through the gaps in my brain. I am outside Elizabeth's house, the sun is slanting onto the drive, and the side gate is open. I can see a sliver of garden through it, golden green. A figure comes down the path from the front door, curly hair, check coat. She smiles at me. "Elizabeth." "It's her. She's been here all along. Elizabeth," I say. "How?" It's not her. It's someone else. As she comes close, I can see she's much younger than Elizabeth. She smiles as she passes me and gets into one of those mobile library vans. I nod and stroke the top of the pebbled wall as if I'm admiring it, and then walk on along the park fence and past the acacia tree. The slender acacia would not shake. One long milk bloom on the tree. The poem comes into my head unbidden. I was made to learn it at school. The teachers thought I ought to know it, and I felt I ought to like it, what with it being called Maud. I did like it in a way, all the dewy flowers and things, but the meaning was completely obscure, and it seemed to get very morbid at the end. Audrey was made to learn the King's Breakfast because her father owned the dairy, and that seemed much more fun. I do like a little bit of butter to my bread. I wait by one of those striped crossings. Lima crossing. Llama crossing. Trying to remember more words. I wonder about milk bloom. What exactly milk bloom might be. And turn to look at the sun slanting across the pavement. Just a moment ago, I had something to do. I watch a few cars go by. A lorry, a library van. Perhaps I was going to see Elizabeth. Except that I can't have been, because she isn't there. I wander towards the house anyway, wishing I could see inside. That would be something. As I get close, I find the side gate is open. There's no one about, so I walk up the path and slip through into the garden. The smell of honeysuckle is thick in the air, and I run a hand up the side of the wall where moss and ivy-leaved toadflax have gathered. There are several patches of raw earth in the lawn, and I wonder if moles have moved in. I walk over to a little hill, finding the soil damp. The smell of it is fresh and sharp, and it makes me think of a song, but I can't think of the name, and I can't find the record. I can't find it, but I'm sure it was buried here.
I put a hand against the apple tree and dip my fingers into the soil, pushing it aside to dig deeper into the ground. I want something smooth and round, silver and blue. But a stone catches the side of my nail and makes me pull away sharply. What on earth am I doing? I look at my hands covered in dirt and sigh. How often I seem to catch myself doing something stupid. I wipe the soil onto my trousers and peer into the dining room through the French windows in case Elizabeth's inside. But her chair by the window is empty. This is where she always sits, looking out and watching the birds. The chair I usually sit in has been pushed back against the wall. No one is expecting me. I let out a breath and leave a cloud on the window. The greenhouse surrounds the kitchen door. I remember when it was full of tomato plants, seedlings, or wintering geraniums. It still smells of damp soil and wood stain, but almost everything has been replaced by cobwebs and boxes and old people paraphernalia. A rusty wheelchair, two walking sticks, and an old bath seat. There are a few empty plant pots, chalky to the touch, lined up against the wall. I drag them across the concrete floor, but there's no key under any of them. The desiccated remains of roots cling to the bottoms, and these break away nicely under my fingers like tiny strips of old wallpaper, leaving white lines on the terracotta. I sit down in the wheelchair, putting my feet up on the footrests. My head is muzzy, as if I've been drinking. There's a key safe on the wall, and I stare at it for a moment. I have one myself, for the carers. A tiny square box which requires four numbers to unlock it. If I was able to guess those numbers, I could get into the house. I think through all the possible significant dates, but I can't remember Elizabeth's birthday or her son's, if I ever knew them. I take bits of paper out of my pockets. A lot of them are appointments. The dentist, the optician, a fete Helen said she would take me to. I can't remember if we ever went. Elizabeth's anniversary. Go round for cheer up. It's on a bright yellow square. I read it several times, but I can't remember what date that was. I shuffle through again. More old reminders. Sun hat in Helen's car, leave it there. Then, on a pink square, I see it. 5th of July, go round and cheer Elizabeth up. Would have been Diamond wedding anniversary. Diamond? That's 60 years. Silver for 25, gold for 50. Patrick and I just made our golden anniversary. We had a big party in the garden, invited the family and friends and neighbours. It was a lovely September day, and after everyone had gone home, he and I sat on the swing hammock until well after dark, watching a bat flit round and round the house. He died before our 51st. I stare out at the garden again, feeling very lonely. I don't know what I would have done without Elizabeth after Patrick went. Those silly games we played at the charity shop, buying up the ugly china and hiding the pricing gun so that Peggy couldn't find it. And all the tea drinking and crosswords and ploughman's lunches, they kept me going. I struggle up from the wheelchair and stand in front of the key safe. 60 years. That would make it 1952? I type it in. No luck. I press my forehead against the cool glass of the kitchen door and scrunch the note into a ball. A dog barks in someone else's garden. The bark has a rusty quality and I find I can't bear the whine of it. I rattle the kitchen door handle, desperate to get away, and my stomach gives a lurch as the door opens into stillness. It was unlocked. I pause on the threshold, trying to think what it means, trying to separate the feeling of something being wrong from the memory of our own kitchen door when I was a child. Never locked until night time. Always unguarded. Just like this one.
Dull light filters through a floral blind, making the surfaces blotchy, and the kitchen smells of disinfectant. It gets me in the back of the throat. I open the top cupboards and the bottom cupboards and find they're empty. The fridge is on, humming away, but it's only got an old tub of margarine in it. I'm hardly sure the lack of food is significant, though. I often have to bring supplies to Elizabeth. Her son keeps her on starvation rations, cheap, tasteless food, which she hates. The dining room doesn't look the way I expect, and I see for the first time how shabby and downtrodden the carpet is. There's something missing. I stare at the polished wooden table and try to remember what should be here, but I can't think of anything in particular. I stand behind Elizabeth's chair and look out of the window. Watching the birds is something we often do together. Elizabeth can identify them just by their shape. She doesn't need to see the colour or anything. Even now she can tell a sparrow from a robin in the twilight. The blackbird spots me from across the garden and half hops, half flies towards me. He lands on the bit of concrete outside the glass and looks in, turning his head one way, then the other. He wants some raisins. Elizabeth keeps a box by her chair and feeds him from the window. He skitters away when I stand up, before coming back to stare up at me again. I can't see raisins anywhere. I'll have to have a check in the kitchen while I make Elizabeth a pot of tea. I wonder if I've remembered to bring any chocolate. I rummage in my handbag, taking out some tissues and an old prescription. I can't find any. Elizabeth will be disappointed. I wish I had remembered. Perhaps I can make something. Scrambled eggs or tomatoes on toast. I could lay the table now. Funny. There's no tablecloth. No placemats or coasters either. Elizabeth's particular about those things. I'll eat over my knees in front of the telly, but Elizabeth likes to have everything nice. The salt and pepper are missing too. And the mango chutney, salad cream, Branston pickle. Elizabeth needs a lot of condiments to go with all the bland food her son gets her. Turning towards the door, I see the writhing shelf of majolica ware is gone. The vases of worms have wriggled away, the plates of beetles and millipedes scuttled off. I hear my breath quicken in the silent room. There's something wrong here. I'm not just visiting. I take out my notes. Elizabeth's name is written over and over. Missing, missing, missing. An engine grunts into silence somewhere close by, and I shuffle into the hall, blinking at the light which pours through the bubbled glass in the front door. I can see the vacuum cleaner marks on the carpet, and on the mat there is a letter addressed to Elizabeth. I bend to pick it up, my hand shaking as I push it into my pocket. A car door slams.
I'll just get the rest of the boxes. You sit tight.
It's Elizabeth's son. I know his voice, and I wonder who it is he is calling to. I hear the scrunch of his feet on the crumbling concrete drive, see the blur of a man through the bubbled glass. Should I run and hide, or will he see me if I move? I stand hunched forward, waiting. The footsteps move away, round the house. There is the clunk of the side gate's latch. I pull back a tiny bit of net curtain from the hall window. It must be Peter's wife in the car, looking anxiously through the windscreen. But there's no Elizabeth with her.
Left the bloody door open. I'll just have a quick check inside.
Peter again. He lays a bath seat in the boot of the car and comes back towards the house. I look around in panic. I mustn't be found here. I mustn't be discovered. I hear the scrunch again of footsteps, the metallic screech of the greenhouse door. My heart pounds. Could I make it up the stairs in time? I'm about to stand and brazen it out when I catch sight of the larder door. The wood creaks and judders against the frame as I pull it open. but the man is busy stumbling over something and shouting about pots left in the way. I throw myself inside and shut the door. The larder smells of polish and stale chocolate, and I'm squashed in against some things, some long, thin things. One has a sponge on the end. One has a brush. I can't think what they're called. There is a vacuum cleaner here, too, with a name written on it. Hoover Hurricane Cyclone System. 2,000-watt power edge cleaning. I whisper the words to myself. It makes me feel better. Footsteps go past, padding on the carpet, sticking on the kitchen lino. I shut my eyes, hearing how jagged my breathing is, hoping it isn't too loud. A fridge door opens and closes. The footsteps go past again and up the stairs. I keep my eyes shut and half crouch against the wall. It's a familiar position. I used to hide in our larder when I was a child. Ours was in the corner of the kitchen, and I especially liked it if there were other people in the room who didn't know I was there. I remember the smell of it. Soil-covered vegetables and pickling spice. Children were always having secret breakfasts in the books I read, and I longed for the things they ate. Sausage rolls and fruit tarts and meat pies. I particularly liked pastry. But we never had so much of that sort of food that it would be left over in the larder. Occasionally I would open a jar of jam or a bowl of stewed apple and eat it with a spoon, or take a slice off the boiled ham. But it wasn't the same, and I'd be in trouble if I was caught. Still, I liked being in there, where it was dark and cool and safe. And when Suki went missing, I started to linger there again, breathing in the familiar smell, enjoying the fact that no one knew where I was. I was standing inside one day, delaying going back to the sitting room, when I heard someone on the steps down from the hall. I knew it was Douglas straight away. He had a sort of loping walk, long strides, but strangely quiet. The scrape of a chair and the crack of a knee made me stare hard at a plate of carrot biscuits, trying to imagine what he was doing. It must only have been a few days after Suki's suitcase turned up, because it was still lying on the floor of the kitchen, waiting for its contents to be sorted and washed. And I distinctly heard the brass clasps snap as Douglas unfastened them. I pushed lightly at the door then, not thinking that I'd give myself away, just desperate to know what he was doing. It opened half an inch, the catch nearly noiseless, and I could just see him, side on, pushing his hand into the tangle of clothes. His mouth was open, and I could hear his breathing, uneven, like waves washing onto a beach. It made me worry that he might hear mine, and I moved back from the door a little, knocking into a shelf. The jars clinked, and I gritted my teeth at the noise. But the wireless was on in the sitting room. Lorna Doone. I could hear music and West Country accents loud enough to cover my twitchings. Douglas kept flicking glances at the steps up to the hall and didn't look in my direction. After a while, he pulled the case away from the dresser and opened it flat. He started to take out the clothes, draping them over a chair. A peach camisole. A shell-coloured slip. A pair of stockings. Everything seemed to be underwear. I couldn't think what he was doing. Except that there had been something in the paper about a man stealing women's knickers off washing lines, and for a second I wondered if Douglas had been that man. But then he started to feel around the sides of the case, and I shook my head at my own thought. He was searching for something. I lift my head from the wall. About time I got out of here. Ma will be wondering where I am.
That's the lot, a voice says.
There are feet on the stairs above me. The noise gives me a jolt and I stop. My hand rests lightly on the door, not pushing.
Everything else can wait for the clearance men, the voice says.
I look round the larder. No jars of jam, no sacks of potatoes. Instead, there's a vacuum cleaner, a broom, a mop.
Still, I can't think where I am.
A door slams, and a car starts up somewhere outside and drives away. I breathe in slowly and step out. This is Elizabeth's hall, Elizabeth's house. But Elizabeth is not here.
The stair lift is at the bottom of the stairs, so she can't be up there.
Or if she is, she's trapped, because she can't make it down without that machine. The top banister looms over me as I walk up, looking like prison bars. But when I reach the landing, I find all the doors are standing open, and that makes me feel better, though I don't know why. Elizabeth's room smells of her rose talcum powder, and for a minute my brain is unreasonable. How can her scent be here and she not? How can one sense tell me she is near and another say I'm wrong? But there's no waste paper bin full of tissues, no Alka-Seltzer next to the bed, and the dressing table's uncluttered surface makes me swallow against tears.
Elizabeth was burgled a few years ago.
The police called it a distraction robbery. A woman kept her talking in the garden, saying she'd lost her cat, while someone else ran in and grabbed the jewellery off the dressing table. I remember exactly what they took. A gold chain, a cameo brooch, and an opal ring. Elizabeth hadn't seemed to mind much about the things, although I think the ring was expensive. She said she thought that it brought bad luck anyway, being an opal. "Well, I hope it brings the thief plenty of bad luck," I said, feeling quite fierce about it. She smiled at that, but she was nervous about being in the house on her own. I thought her son might take her to stay with him that night, but he was busy, and thought she was fussing about nothing as no one had actually broken in. I couldn't take her home with me. It was too far for her to walk. So I stayed the night, sleeping on the other single bed, which had been her husband's. We talked into the dark and sang old songs until we fell asleep. I lower myself onto the bed now, digging a pen and a bit of paper from my bag. Elizabeth's house searched. Definitely not there. That's something to show Helen. I tuck the note away, and I find I'm listening to something. I imagine my ears pricked like a dog's, pointing up and alert. A whirring has started somewhere close. I know the sound, so familiar, so associated with Elizabeth. A mechanical noise, one note gradually getting louder and nearer. It's the stairlift. The stairlift coming up towards me. My mouth goes dry in panic. There is no one in the house. No one. So, who is coming up the stairs? My heart beats harder and harder in my chest until I think it might give out, and my legs feel weak. But I make myself stand. The lift stops. I don't want to move, to betray the fact that I'm here. I stand for a long time, hardly daring to breathe. When nothing happens, I drop a balled tissue onto the carpet, marking my place, and walk out onto the landing. The lift is empty. It has stopped two-thirds of the way up, and there is no one on it at all. I stare at it, my tongue sticky with fear. Shaking, I back away into Elizabeth's room and shut myself in. I collapse back onto the bed, and my hand touches something hard. The stairlift remote control. I was sitting on it. My breath rings out as I sink backwards and lie still, looking up at the ceiling, watching the shadows change. Every now and then a car goes by, and I can hear the whoosh of it as it turns the corner in front of the house. I imagine the sea is just outside, and the cars are waves. Or that I'm holding a shell to my ear, listening to the rush of my own blood. Eventually, I get up. Bring the stairlift to the landing with the remote control. Settle into it. And ride down.
Chapter 9.
Helen should be here soon. Any minute her car will drive up in front. If I kneel on the window seat, lean on one hand and put the side of my head against the glass, I can see almost to the end of the street. I want Helen to come. I want to see her car drive up, hear the reassuring sound of tires scrunching on the tarmac outside the house. There's nothing I need. I just need her. My daughter. I lean over again to look up the road. The wind catches the shrubs in the front garden, beating them against the gatepost, and the noise of it, the rustling, the sharp shuffling, makes me shudder. I find I'm staring very hard at the gaps in the branches. A car comes by, the headlights swinging onto the house, and the gate, and the hedge. And for a second, I think I see someone crouching amongst the leaves, a hand crushing the fragile stems, and a mouth open to eat or shout. I scramble backwards. The cushion slips from under me, and I lose my balance, dropping onto the floor. There's a sudden sharp pain in my thumb and a crunching sound. I whip my hand up in shock, letting out a wail and holding my thumb in the other hand. I hold it tight, and the pain subsides. I can't think what I've done. Hush, hush, I say, cradling the hand. Helen used to hold my thumb when she was a baby. Sometimes she holds my hand now, but not very often. There's the sound of a car behind me, and I turn in hope, but it only glides past, not stopping. It wasn't Helen at the wheel anyway. The street light shone on a fair-haired man. So the street lights are on, but I didn't notice it get dark. I stare out of the window and feel a hollowing of my insides. Helen doesn't come this late. She isn't coming tonight. Or perhaps, it's unlikely, but perhaps she's already been. And I've forgotten. I stare out at the empty street. Tears make the lights sparkle, and I lift a hand to wipe them away, feeling a sharp pain in my thumb. I gasp in shock, but I can't think what I've done to it. I look across to the telephone, but it seems miles away. Far too far away for me ever to get to it. I seem to have this feeling more and more. I suppose it's my age. It's how I always thought getting old would be. But I remember this sort of tiredness from when I was ill the summer after Suki disappeared. I hadn't been sleeping, and my brain seemed to be too hot and tired to work properly. I forced myself through the kitchen door one morning on my way to school and found that I couldn't make it to the end of the road. I was walking for what felt like miles, but had barely got past Mrs. Winner's gate. I looked back towards home, but it seemed to have moved further off, as if it was going out for the day, same as I was. I didn't know what to do, and so I just stood still for a moment, hoping to get my breath. And of course, it was Mrs. Winners herself who found me, collapsed on the pavement, not unconscious, but not quite right in the head either. I remember the feel of the pavement, chalky under my hands, and the smell of perfume as Mrs. Winners came out of her house. I remember thinking it was really lovely, the way a warm sweater is when you're cold. I kept breathing in the scent as she helped me up and back to my house. I was in bed for weeks and weeks after that, staring at the light patterns on the wall and straining to hear the radio in the sitting room. Ma had it brought up to my bedroom for a while, but it made me sleep fitfully, and what I needed most of all was rest. Both my parents were very worried. I found out after. Dad hardly ever came in to see me because he was sure I would die, and he couldn't face it,
what with Suki gone. Ma was more anxious about my mind. She said I talked a lot in my sleep and some of it frightened her. I'm not surprised I talked. I must have been really delirious at one stage, because there were several times when I thought Suki was lying on her old bed staring at me. And once, when I saw Douglas doing the same, I had lots of strange visions. I saw Suki with her hair tangled, telling me she didn't have a comb. And I kept saying, "I gave you one, Suki, don't you remember?" And I saw hundreds of snails all over the ceiling. And once I saw the mad woman leaning over me, her teeth bared and her umbrella raised. And I heard songs over and over, silly Vera Lynn songs that I didn't even like. And I thought I heard mice scratching in the skirting and bombs dropping over the town and my friend Audrey calling me. And there was the constant roll of waves close to my ear, although I had no shells to listen to. And one time, I was sure someone had come in the back door, but when I called down, I got no answer. "It's nice to be home," I say to Helen. "Nice to be back in my own home after all this time. We've come from the hospital. I had to go because of some problem. What was it now? Anyway, it's nice to be home. You were only at the hospital for a few hours, Mum. Don't overdo it." She drops her car keys onto the coffee table. "No, Helen," I say. "It was longer than that. Several weeks. Perhaps months. A long, long time." "A few hours," she says again. "Why must you argue? I'm just saying that it's nice to be back." I hit my hand on the chair arm and it makes a muffled thud. "It's all bandaged up." "Okay, Mum, you're right," I hear Helen say. "It's always nice to be home again, isn't it? And I thought you'd feel better after a visit." "I know it wasn't very nice. I know it was a bit sad, but at least you can stop worrying now." "I don't know what she's wittering on about. Can't you see my hand's a giant white cocoon? I can't move it like this. I don't think I need to have these bandages on any more," I say. "I think it's about time I remove them, don't you?" I start to unwind the white strips of material. "No, no, no, Mum, please." She rushes towards me and cradles my hand in hers. "You have to keep them on until the sprain has healed. It'll be a little while yet." "Nonsense, Helen," I say. "I haven't sprained it. It doesn't hurt." I pull away from her and wave my hand in the air to prove it. "Even so, leave it on, for me. Please." I shrug and tuck the hand between my thigh and the side of the chair so I don't have to look at it. "Thank you," Helen says. "Shall I make you some tea?" "And a little bit of toast," I say, "with some cheese." "Maybe later, Mum," she says, leaving the room. "The nurse says you should cut down a bit." "Oh, yes, I forgot. The nurse says I'm getting fat. She says it's because I forget when I've eaten." "You're not getting fat," Helen calls from the hall. "You just need a better diet. More varied, less bread-based." I have a note that the nurse made for me. "Are you hungry? If not, don't make any toast." I'm surprised they let me decide for myself if I'm hungry. No wonder you hear about old people starving to death in hospitals, what with nurses telling them to stop eating all the time. Beneath the note is a list of care homes, and I feel a sudden weight on my chest. Am I to go into one? I listen to Helen in the kitchen, to the innocent sound of cups being taken down from the cupboard. Would she? I look at the list more carefully. My hands are shaking. There are a few names with cross-throughs, and lots more with question marks. One or two of the cross-throughs have N-O-E next to them.
What does that mean?
N-O-E.
It looks like my handwriting, but Helen's is very like mine.
Mill Lane. N-O-E.
Or perhaps more like N-O-E. North of England, perhaps. Is that where the home is?
My God, that's it. But how would I ever see Helen or Katie if I moved there?
This one is crossed through, though, and maybe that's why. Too far away. I relax a little.
Still, I don't want to go into a home. Not yet. I'm not old enough.
I must tell Helen. I must call her now and tell her. As I get up to find the phone, the bits of paper fall from my lap onto the floor. Damn and blast, I say, getting onto my knees to shuffle them together. My left hand won't move. It's covered in white bandages, though I can't see why. It feels fine. Perhaps Katie was playing nurse again. Well, I can't keep it like this. I pull at the end of the material and unwind it. A piece of plastic falls away as I do. The hand looks crumpled and pale. Katie did it too tight. I hope she doesn't grow up to be a real nurse. I start to scoop up the bits of paper and a sharp pain shoots through my thumb. I cry out. Helen rushes into the room. What happened? She says, breathless.
My hand! My hand! I say, waving it at her.
It doesn't hurt so much now I'm not trying to use it, but the memory makes me rock about and wail. I told you not to take the bandage off, Helen says. Christ's sakes, Mum!
She holds my wrist tightly and starts to wrap the material round again.
What are your notes doing on the floor?
I look at the bits of paper. One has a list on it.
I don't want to go into a home, Helen, I say.
She stops winding.
You're not going into one, Mum.
I nod, but I can still see the list lying on the carpet. Helen looks too.
Oh, God, I thought you'd chuck that list away. That's your old list, she says, for...
She stops and narrows her eyes.
Don't you remember? What were you looking for?
I have to tilt my head to frown at her, but my neck muscles are still tight from shock.
What could I have been looking for? Elizabeth, I say. And I feel as if my limbs are suddenly lighter. My back straightens. So it's no E. No Elizabeth.
Right. She finishes safety pinning my bandage and pulls the notes into a pile.
Only you don't need these numbers anymore, do you? And we were going to put the list in the recycling, so you don't call the care homes again.
Were we? I say, snatching at the paper. I think I'll hang on to it for a bit anyway.
Helen tries to tug the list from my grasp, but I won't let go, and she soon gives up. Well, that was a waste of time, she says. I'll finish getting the tea.
And a little bit of toast?
Toast was practically all Ma would allow me to eat that summer I was ill. Thin soup with dry toast, creamed rice for a treat. I knew I was nearly better the evening she brought me a little mutton chop. Though I don't know how you deserve this, she said, resting the tray on my lap. What with all the bread and jam you had at breakfast.
I had porridge for breakfast, didn't I? I said, hardly paying attention, my mouth watering at the smell of the meat. You gave it to me.
Yes, and then as soon as I was out to the grocer's, you sneaked down for bread and jam. Half the loaf's missing.
Ma, I didn't.
Maud, love, you can have whatever you want. I'm glad you have an appetite again. But I have to plan what I'm going to do with our rations and...
Ma, really?
I said, chewing my first mouthful quickly and swallowing so I could defend myself properly.
I didn't have the bread. It wasn't me.
That's funny. Can't have been your father.
She moved my glass of milk a fraction and unfolded a tea towel for me to use as a napkin.
Do you think Douglas would take food?
Doesn't seem like him.
It really didn't seem like him, but there wasn't another explanation.
I suppose he could have come back and made a sandwich to take on his late morning rounds, I said.
I gave him a good breakfast, though, Ma said, looking offended. I never send him or your father off without that.
I wiped my mouth and shrugged. Perhaps he took it for someone else.
What? You mean he's feeding someone? If he is, I'll be wanting their coupons.
There was someone in the house, I say, hanging onto the banisters.
Why won't anyone believe me?
I do believe you, Mum, Helen says. But it was just a carer. A new carer, that's all. She wasn't a burglar. There was no need to call the police.
Mind out the way, will you?
She pushes by, and I watch her running a cloth along the skirting board. She leans and swishes her hands along, like some sort of athletics.
Like those exercises we were supposed to do when we were young. Bending from the waist to keep trim. They always showed fields full of women doing them at the same time. Smiling. It never made me smile to do them.
Helen follows the skirting into the sitting room, and I follow her.
1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. Keep smiling, girls.
What are you on about? God, it was embarrassing. Heaven knows what she thought. You accusing her like that. Telling everyone you were being robbed. By the carer, she adds, when I look at her blankly.
What would you do if you came down to breakfast and found a stranger in your kitchen?
Not a stranger, a carer.
Yes, yes, so she says. But how do I know she's telling the truth?
She could be anyone. Helen lets her hands drop to her sides and leaves the room.
This is supposed to mean something. I push my toes into the carpet as I go after her, careful not to slip. Careful.
I'm not safe in my own bed, I say,
though I'm losing track of what it is I'm in danger of. Surely it wouldn't be possible to slip over when I'm in bed.
Helen, where exactly is it best to grow summer squash?
She doesn't answer, and when I get to the hall it's empty.
Oh, where have you gone? I say. Why'd you keep hiding?
I'm not hiding, Helen says, coming out of the dining room. I'm trying to get the soil off the walls.
You've scuffed it over everything. Again.
I don't know how you manage it. She scrubs at a low bit of wall, moving up the stairs. I watch her heels on the steps, bouncing, and follow slowly, trying to place my feet in exactly the same position, trying for the same bounce. It's better walking after another person. You can see how the steps work, and you can trust where they are when someone else has tested them first. I watch closely, but I don't notice when she stops, and my shoulder bumps her on the hip.
Oh, Mum, will you stop following me? She says. Stay in the kitchen. I'll be back in a minute.
I tramp back down and look out of the window. There's a cat on the lawn, and I try to open the kitchen door, but there's something wrong with the handle.
You've left me open to attack here, I say to Helen when she reappears. With these flimsy locks.
And this door is made of Bakelite or something. What's the use of that?
The wooden one was rotted through. What was the use of that?
And I want that thing removed from outside the door. It spits the key out to anyone.
Not unless you have the code.
Well, someone's been writing it down, leaving it for burglars. I've got one of the notes here. Look.